This program is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners. Show your support at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This week on Meet in 3, we're embracing the spooky spirit of Halloween, from zombies to witches. We're exploring the odd, the occult, and the taboo in the world of food.
There are restaurants with no storefront, shrunken down into hundreds of square feet versus thousands of square feet. No servers, no hosts, nobody taking your order.
The rats in the sewers are now smelling, all of a sudden, fresh food molecules. And those rats were like, holy cow, follow that scent.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Allison Kane, and welcome to In the Sauce, a podcast about building consumer brands from the ground up. I love doing this show because I get to interview everyone from production gurus to marketing and social media mavens, anyone who can guide me on this crazy journey. This is the story of building Haven's Kitchen sauces, but it's also the story of every growing brand because we're all in the sauce. Today, I'm speaking with Ben Goodwin and Eli Weiss, respectively the founder CEO and the customer service director at Olipop, the low-sugar, probiotic, fiber-rich, healthy soda alternative that is, as they say, killing it. If you're following consumer products these days at all, you'll probably recognize Olipop since it's been steadily gaining traction on the East Coast after it blew everyone away in California. Earlier this year, Olipop launched its D2C channel, and with that came a whole new meaning to customer service. So I asked Ben and Eli to come on together to talk about the company, but also to focus on customer service, because we haven't really talked that much about this on the podcast. So welcome both.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And there's Eli. And I got a good tip early on when we went remote that I should try directing the questions so that there isn't that awkward pause where you're waiting for each other to answer.
Fair enough.
So I'm going to try to do that. Welcome, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Welcome, Eli.
Hey, hey. It's great to be here.
hey. So I want to talk about CX, as the cool kids call it, especially in the world of direct-to-consumer. It's kind of got a whole new meaning, and we've gotten a bit of a, I think they call it, baptism by fire or something. There's some expression. We've had to learn it pretty quickly. I have a brick and mortar background, so I sort of have this like, well, I have customer service in my bones, but it's a different animal. So I do want to get to that, but Ben, I also just want to get to Olipop. It's like, if I had a crush on a brand, this is the brand that I have a crush on. I am not alone. And I think that's normal to have a crush on a brand, right? And I'm not a big soda person, but I just think everything is just clicking so beautifully for you. So I want to hear a little bit. I know this is not your first rodeo.
Yeah.
I want to hear about you and David, I believe, is your co-founder.
Mm-hmm.
And just how Olipop came to be.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it has been quite a journey. I've been a product developer in the health and wellness space, and specifically in the kind of microbiome and digestive health space for pretty much 15 years.
Right.
So seeing some of the show notes that you are aware of all that, but I mean, it all basically started, you know, early on in my life, I ate what is often referred to as the standard American diet. Mm-hmm. And as is typically the case with the standard American diet, it didn't work out too well for me physiologically. Right. So I grew up as this kind of overweight younger kid. And when I was actually fairly young, 14 or 15, I had the epiphany that this, along with some other things that were happening in my life, was not really going to lead to a good life. Like, for
very mature.
Yeah. I mean, it was, it literally like hit me overnight. I just actually recorded a way too elongated podcast about my life where I go into harrowing levels of detail and all this. But the basic point is it literally was an overnight thing. And so I just woke up the next morning and was like, all right, screw this. I'm going to start eating less and eating healthier and exercising and yada, yada, yada. And I also went vegetarian around that time because I learned what factory farms were. Mm-hmm. I'm not a vegetarian now. I'm super picky and try to be very mindful about the animal products I consume. But at the time I was like full-blown vegetarian. I actually went vegan for a while as well. So I'm like, you know, I'm trying to pay attention to my physical health and I'm trying to have this kind of overhaul of my health. And I'm also shifting diets and I don't want to lose any kind of critical nutrients. And the way my brain works is when I get into stuff, I get a little, maybe I get really into stuff. And especially if I feel like it's got this a healthful, empowering component to it. And as I went down this rabbit hole on nutrition, I started experimenting more and more and more and eating all sorts of different types of foods. Mm-hmm. And the big kind of click moment for me was a couple of years into this transformation when, okay, fine, I lost a bunch of weight. I lost like 60 pounds in less than a year at 14, 15.
Yeah.
So obviously I had more energy. I felt more comfortable with in my skin. But as I went, kind of got more into the concentrated nutrition, I found it was affecting not just my physical health, but also really like my mental stability, my emotional stability, my speed of thought, my clarity of thought. It's just giving more energy. And I really viewed it as this mechanism, as this is kind of like a base of the pyramid of what I basically like to call like self-actualization or it's a personal empowerment tool.
Right.
And I recognize, you know, I have the kind of insanity, if you would, to like really tunnel down this hole. But then a lot of people I'm kind of seeing in society around me are not doing the same. And I'm really seeing the difference in terms of how it's affecting their lives. So that is kind of what broadly made me interested in, you know, converting my life energies into the food and health and wellness space and trying to create these different kind of vehicles for personal empowerment and wellness is because of how it affected me.
Wow.
You know, I participated in a buddy of mine was starting a kombucha company, which I joined when I was 20. I did a lot of
in
the
college. Like, did you go to college?
I did go to college and then I dropped out. So I am a college dropout. I was going for environmental science. I was going to UC Santa Cruz, actually.
Right.
And that's a whole long story. I had a mentor who's a civil rights activist. He actually won a Supreme Court case by himself without legal representation in 1983. He's the reason why it's illegal for police to ask you for your ID without probable cause, although that's been undermined by the Patriot Act, et cetera, et cetera. But so I was also throwing raves. I do a lot of stuff. Wow. I was throwing these raves, these different events. He ended up coming to one. He was also, in addition to being the civil rights activist, he was also a pretty meaningful event producer. He was taking over this theater in Monterey. He was taking over as the executive producer for this theater in Monterey. He went to one of my shows, really liked what I did. I actually ended up just seeing him out in public like 2 weeks later, struck up a conversation with him because I had recognized him as an attendee at one of my events.
Right.
And he's like, I liked your work. Why don't you come down to the theater and we could talk about, you know, you basically working with me, you know, helping me to produce these events. So I did. End up being these like 10-hour long, you know, multi-day conversations on, you know, basically it was just like, okay, here's some good mind expanding information on the structure of society, and, you know, on the structure of how things are laid out. I obviously found it really fascinating and inspiring.
You got educated. Yep.
Yeah. And, you know, one of the things that I took away from that was, you know, this gentleman, obviously he had the raw neurological firepower and the oratory skills to execute on this, but he, you know, basically just went to the Berkeley Law Library, studied up on the law. And that's how he became, that's the methodology by which he actually accomplished the knowledge set to generate this great outcome. And so, you know, I don't know, it's overly simplistic, but at the time, I was just like, you know, I come from like a relatively like impoverished childhood, like financially. And it was like, I'm going to be putting myself through college. And I just kept going to all these different events, even orientation. It was like, if you show up with $400, you could sign up for classes now. And if you don't, you have to sign up in 2 weeks. And I was just like, well, I don't have $400. Am I just going to keep being in this position where every time you can get ahead with finance? So I just kind of viewed myself as being a little bit of a cash machine for the university. Yeah. I was getting this kind of alternative psychological framework. I also did read the founder of Cliff Bar put out an interesting book about entrepreneurialism.
Yeah.
About taking the alternative path. I read that. And it's, I don't know, it all kind of clicked together that, and this is, again, it's a little bit of the overly simplistic logic.
But yeah, it's hard to sum up, you know, 30 or 20 years in 6 minutes. So it's
100%. Yeah. And I'm also being too long-winded. But I guess I got to the point where I realized that I was attending college because I was scared of what would happen if I didn't.
Right.
I wasn't sure that it was totally the right fit for me and my trajectory as a human being. So I decided to just get right involved directly with entrepreneurialism with products.
Yeah.
And so as a part of that, I was looking for different opportunities, felt strangely drawn to beverage. A friend of mine was starting a kombucha company. So I got involved with that, helped do a lot of the productions, you know, a lot of the ops and production and product work. And that's also when I learned about the microbiome.
Right.
So that's a whole long thing, but basically one of the functions of the microbiome is this thing called the brain gut axis.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the idea that you produce a lot of neurotransmitters, which impact your thinking and your mood. And those are actually fermented in your microbiome. And I had that kind of eureka moment, like, oh, this might be the place where, that kind of stability of psychology and emotional outcome meet with what you are choosing to put in your body or not put in your body. So,
right. Which seems, you know, now seems fairly obvious. And yet, I mean, 15 years ago, that was not obvious at all. And 100%. I mean, I listened to GT Dave's How I Built This. And if anyone hasn't, it's kind of fascinating, but, you know, kombucha and fermentation and even just understanding sort of the standard/sad American diet, you know, no one was really talking about that mainstream until Michael Pollan, Omnivore's Dilemma, 2012, right? 2011. And, you know, now everyone's like, obviously what you eat is going to affect your, you know, your thinking, your sleeping, your skin, your brain, your mood, all of it. But that's unusual for a 20-year-old kid to put together. And then to kind of, it sounds like it was sort of serendipitous that your friend wasn't starting, you know, a luggage company. He was starting a kombucha company, which is like right in your line of, you know, like right in your, I don't know, I'm picturing like a golf course and like you're like right in the line of your driver or whatever.
It's a great point. Bad
sports metaphors on this podcast. And I am not an athlete, which is very obvious from the metaphors that I use, but for some reason they always come out of me. So you worked in the kombucha company. You obviously learned a lot. And then did you go and then start OB yourself? Like you then went and founded another company or?
Yeah. So I did leave the kombucha company after about 2 years and then did a bunch of like assorted product development just to kind of, I wanted to learn how to make a bunch of different stuff. And so I did that. I also talked to a lot of customers about their health issues, which was really eye-opening for me. Probably technically shouldn't have been talking to them about health issues, given I'm not a doctor.
You were doing consumer research.
Yeah. But a lot of customers do end up coming to health food companies and talking about different issues that they probably, you know, in theory would ideally be able to go talk to their doctor about. So I felt like I was getting a lot of insight and experience. But then, you know, as a young guy in your 20s doing product development, you know, and making a living off of it, living in expensive California, I did feel like I often ended up making the kind of more esoteric product or the more high-end product, making products for consumers who maybe already had too many products and health products. And I did want to do something at larger scale. And I knew I wanted to do it in the kind of digestive and microbiome space. And I just kind of had this idea of, all right, I've done work in kombucha. I've seen how kombucha, you know, especially at that time is really taking off. But then I obviously have this direct experience, like for every one person who can get behind the vinegar taste of kombucha, there's like 5 to 10 people who are like that, not in a million years.
Right.
So I'm like, those people are missing out on the benefits of fermentation. So that basically kicked off OB. That was the R&D process on that was really long. I mean, that was just like a wild gambit. That was insane. I mean, it was totally insane. I spent over $300,000 of my own cash from working 3 different jobs while I was also living bicoastally, building these different fermentation facilities and working with a microbiologist and organic chemist and flavor chemist. And we basically mutated our own culture bank. And then I learned, which is, you know, roughly modeled on water kefir, and then learned how to build that in a scaled facility, and all these kind of biochemical systems that kept the ferment in check. It was a pretty daunting experience. And then
right.
eventually kind of put that into a soda-esque format, you know, also because I started to have this idea of like, it's not audacious enough just to try to overhaul the fermentation, healthy fermentation opportunity, but I also want to now also take a dig at soda. So
right.
that was logical, but you know, through that process, I had been looking for a business partner. Actually, for 3 years, I was looking for a business partner.
Right.
You know, I had some relationships that didn't quite fit, so I had to move on from them. And that is eventually where I actually met David. It was probably about like year 3.5 or year 4 into that R&D cycle. And it was really like, it was amazing timing. You know, David's an amazing human being. We gel really, really nicely. Like, you know, I'm kind of the
mad scientist.
Yeah, I'm the mad scientist, slightly less psychologically stable, but right. maybe a little bit more willing to take risks and pivots. You know, I have the kind of ops and technical background. You know, David's this like, if you ever talk to him, he's a smooth, polished, you know, British guy who uh-huh. has a background in blue chip CPG with Diageo and really worked on like the brand and marketing right. side. Rolling out innovation.
It's like a perfect, like Arnold Schwarzenegger, Danny DeVito twins yeah. scenario. Yeah.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. I will not say who's who, but.
Yeah. I'm not sure who's who either, but I like it. Or yeah. like, you know, yeah. I don't want to say Beavis and Butthead, but something like that. Yeah.
That synergy kicked in. You know, we got the branding together. I actually had
this
the
is
right.
This is still at OBI, like this, because there was another soda, right? Is that
so? OBI basically turned into what we ended up calling like a probiotic soda, and then we kind of actually took soda off of the label because at that time, especially coastal consumers, weren't super open to the concept of a healthy right. soda. I think that is shifting, and we're also playing on a national level now, so there's different regions that respond differently to the concept, but right. you know, at the time it had a lot of soda characteristics, like we right. did have okay. a root beer and we had lemon lime and stuff right. like that.
And he yeah, came into that business with you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he came in pre-launched that business as I was wrapping up this gargantuan R&D effort. He came in, the fit was correct between the two of us, and that got it going, you know, as a business. So we were in that company for about 2 years. We did end up exiting in late 2016. That's kind of a long story, which I don't super want to get into because there are some different dynamics. But we ended up basically growing the thing by about 250% year on year, picked up a bunch of accolades for the product and the innovation. And then, you know, there's these different dynamics where we decided that it was a good time to exit in late 2016. So we did.
Amazing.
Yes.
And then did you know that you were going to do another one? Like, were the two of you like, okay, now we can
really my God.
Do what we want to do?
Well, so that, I mean, that's the thing. Like, beverage entrepreneurialism is, it's like being in a 55 round boxing match. Yeah. Like, just intrinsically, it's, especially if you're trying to come from a place of legitimate mission and like authenticity, right. you know, it's there's a lot of intensity associated with it, and you know, it's like managing the stress and managing the different dynamics, and the mm-hmm. fundraising is this constant drumbeat and all that kind of stuff. So we actually did not immediately come out of that venture knowing if we wanted to do something again. You know, we actually had a lot of conversations about it. I actually hopped on a plane and spent a couple of weeks in Japan, and just kind of like, which place I'd always wanted to go, and I cooled my head and I like drank a lot of Japanese drinks, and you know, to like kind of just try to figure out what we wanted to do next. And we did kind of come to the concept of like, you know, basically like if we're gonna go after it again, we've just got to do it like 10 times better. You know, I'm not, right. if I go for one punch and I'm like, I feel good about that punch, but it wasn't everything I wanted it to be. Yeah. I'm coming back like infinitely, like the next one's gonna land and connect and go all the way through it. So
yeah, and that's why I love having like people who've done it before on, because I will ask you after, like, I want to know sort of the things that you were like, this was a B or a C plus in my last one, this has to be an A plus in this one. Like, what were those things? And we'll get to it after the intro section. But I love having second or serial entrepreneurs on for that very reason, because we make so many mistakes and there's so many things even now that I'm like advising people, you know, 3 months behind me not to do. So I can, even if it doesn't, the first venture isn't out of the park, which it sounds like yours was pretty close, you still learn so much that the second time around, you're just inevitably gonna make some smarter decisions probably.
I agree 100%. And I think that that is especially true in CPG broadly, and then doubly true in beverage, because beverage is, I mean, that's one of the things that's funny is like, I don't, coming from more of this scientific, even artistic, you know, background, I'm not the kind of natural business kind of archetype, you know? So it is really like, yeah, it's like, so jumping into an industry which is actually business on expert mode as your starting place, it's going to be turbulent. Like, it's not, you know, you're going to have to learn a lot and super quickly. And that actually is part of why I chose entrepreneurialism. So that works for me, but that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, if we figure out if we're going to come back, we're going to come back harder. I started looking at the research, trying to find out, which is, you know, basically my go-to at this point in time when I'm deciding whether or not a kind of basically like a product deserves to exist. Is there kind of like research around it? Is there, is there meaningful value? Are we solving a human problem? Are we actually, and we're doing it in a way that's credible? And that's when I started to see this kind of downshift in the credibility, the scientific credibility behind probiotics. That's a whole long conversation, but you know, it's enough to say that basically like in the EU, the European Food Safety Authority, which is basically Europe's FDA, doesn't even allow companies to make probiotic claims. They've rejected
it. Right, because they die before you even open the bottle, right?
The vast majority of them are dead in the bottle or the pill. Yep. And the ones that aren't, most of those die in the gastric acid or the mouth.
Right.
The very few, the like 10% that actually make it where they need to go, they're also quite transitory. So they'll typically excrete it out within 24 to 72 hours. Yep. So there's a long conversation there. But basically, you know, obviously a bit of a bummer to me given I still believe in fermentation. I just think there's a lot of weaknesses in our in the way we approach probiotics, which is now basically being borne out through the research.
Right.
And then there's this other line of study that's been popping up. Because to your point, the point that you made earlier, it's like the microbiome research broadly is a burgeoning field, right? It's like new discoveries all the time. Things are shifting. So that's very exciting. And one of those shifts was this trend of research studying different indigenous hunter-gatherers, you know, basically people who've been eating these indigenous diets that, that you know, we were consuming for millions of years before we got to where we are now. That basically the differences in those diets and the differences in their microbiome and their health outcomes. And, you know, basically preening through all the research and realizing that the big difference both in the individual research and in the translational research is industrialized consumers are not getting enough fiber.
Right.
They're not getting enough prebiotics and they're not getting enough nutritional diversity. And so those are the three big things I wanted to encapsulate into Olipop and then obviously translate into, you know, what we like to kind of phrase as the kind of this Trojan horse of putting into this like very accessible, delicious, well-branded soda product. And that's Olipop.
Yeah. And I mean, so quick question about that. Obviously, I understand coming from like a degree in sustainability, I understand biodiversity, like the back of my hand, and I understand fiber. Can you just break down the difference between fiber and a prebiotic? Because I always thought fiber just prepared your body for, you know, I always thought of it as a prebiotic, but obviously there's a difference between fiber and prebiotics. Will you just explain that?
Absolutely. So first of all, if there's a little confusion on your end or anybody's end, don't blame yourself. Like even the regulatory terminology has shifted over the last year or so. So it's like, it's not. So basically fiber broadly exists in two buckets. There's soluble fiber and insoluble fiber.
Okay,
so insoluble fiber is roughage. It basically is stuff that you're not breaking down with your mouth. You're not breaking down with your gastric acids. It's largely going into your body and passing out of your body in an undigested state. Now, roughage is really important because it basically provides this kind of defensive flotilla to make sure that the food that you're consuming actually gets to key areas of the digestive tract and microbiome where it can do the most good. Right. So if you're eating food that doesn't have enough roughage, what's basically going to happen is you're going to have too much breakdown of that food in the large intestines, where you might be feeding bacteria you don't want to feed, or it's just the sugar is going to go into your bloodstream too quickly, which is going to cause insulin spikes, et cetera, et cetera. So fiber is really good at making sure the food breaks down at a nice slow pace and that enough of the valuable nutrients get to the large intestines, which is where the majority of your digestive microbiome live. It also is kind of a bit of a workout for your digestive tract, which turns out is actually important.
Right.
Then there's soluble fiber. So soluble fiber, the solubility is solubility in water or liquid. That's where the soluble comes from. Soluble fiber is more likely to be a prebiotic. It's not always a prebiotic, but it is oftentimes a prebiotic. And so it's just chemically, structurally, it's different. The soluble fiber that is a prebiotic can't be broken down mastically, can't be broken down in the gastric acids. The reason why it's prebiotic is because it has a molecular structure that beneficial microorganisms living inside of you have the right kind of set of tools to open up. So it delivers basically useful nutrients right to the beneficial microorganisms that you're trying to grow. Now, there are some things, historically, pretty much everything that's been classified as a prebiotic has also fallen into the soluble fiber bucket.
Okay.
Recently, the FDA has expanded the definition of prebiotics. So there's things like there's certain polysaccharides, there's certain metabolites. There are some other ingredients that fall outside of the fiber spectrum that technically also have been shown to have a beneficial effect on the growth of certain microorganisms and therefore get the tag of prebiotic.
Amazing. And you took sort of the idea of Americans need more fiber and they need these prebiotics, and Americans really like soda, and let's just hash the two together and disrupt the whole thing.
Correct. Yeah.
Right. I want to get to Eli since you've been sitting patiently and hear a little bit about how you came to your career. I feel like you are the customer service whisperer. I feel like you're always, I don't know. And I think, you know, you said something in a LinkedIn post or you said something at some point about not just sort of appeasing the consumer, but really thinking about it as a marketing channel. And I quote you all the time. I think the question always gets to is like, how do you sort of, do customer service in a different way or in a special way or in a way that really reflects the ideals of the company, which we'll get to. But I want to hear how you ended up being the customer experience guy. Obviously, you were at a couple of other companies before, and I'm curious about the difference between how it works at different places. And I also think it's really interesting. You guys haven't met in person yet. So I'm kind of curious about that. So Eli, I'm going to let you talk about your career for a couple minutes and then, talk about how you guys met. And then we're going to take a break and then get into serious, tactical support for founders out there. So take
Sounds
it away.
Great. Yeah. Sounds great. Thank you so much. It's pretty funny. I feel like I've been doing this for 5-6 years. And I think in April was when I started kind of tweeting some of the thoughts that I thought were a little different than what everyone else in the space was saying. And it kind of took off, which is weird and humbling at the same time. But I'm glad that people are kind of taking this new approach to customer experience. And I think that kind of ties into the difference between customer service and customer experience, you know, whether it's a reactive measure where, you know, something's broken, let's fix it, versus constantly being proactive and looking ahead as to how can we, you know, make this experience more effortless? How can we remove friction? How can we grow a brand and use it as a marketing channel? But before I hop into that, a little bit about me, I worked at a couple of small companies in Jersey as a young adult. As a child, I think I was fairly charismatic, which kind of pushed my parents to constantly tell me I should be doing sales. And my first couple of jobs were sales, and I just really hated it. Like, I felt that my superpower was like understanding people. Empathy. And it felt like, it felt like using that to sell someone something just didn't feel right. And I started traveling at the age of like 21. That was my kind of like substitute for college. I figured instead of taking all that money to go to school and learn something I'm not even sure I want to learn at that age, I'd rather kind of go out and get a little real life MBA and learn about people and culture. And I ended up in Israel, which is when I kind of got really excited about the startup world. Tel Aviv had like a pretty fantastic scene then. And that's kind of where I found this direct consumer luggage company. When I joined, I think it was like 2014, I kind of fell in love with the idea of direct consumer because of the connection you're able to have with customers. And that went both ways. You know, if you mess something up, you heard about that really fast.
You're very open to them.
And if you did something right, you heard about that really fast. And I thought that kind of was just this insightful way of creating a company based on immediate feedback loop. And at that stage, I think I just started getting super interested in customer experience, but that wasn't my first role at all. These companies was much more a general role. These were companies that had 4 or 5 employees. Olipop is actually the largest company I've ever been at. So I was at these tiny companies doing all these more generalist, you know, jobs. I was doing ops, I was doing logistics. This was like a Kickstarter company. So we were shipping to 64 countries with 6 different warehouses.
And
I always kind of excelled with the customer experience part of it, because I felt like there was kind of between the lines that the customers weren't saying, but were saying, and nobody else was catching that.
I'm going to interrupt you for a second, because I think so much of what I've learned doing this podcast and what I've learned sort of being in brick and mortar and now in like the CPG world is that, you know, like you said before, Ben, you want to make sure that you have a product that actually solves a human problem. And you want to make sure that like you're not just, you know, throwing something into the wind that you hope that people like, but that you're actually in service of people somehow. And yet a lot of times, you know, we put this thing out that's theoretically out there to solve a problem, but then for some reason, the consumer almost becomes sort of like the impediment to you putting something out there. Like it's like companies forget that empathy and consumers, you know, I mean, there's like a quote attributed to Henry Ford. We're not sure if it was actually him who said it. Also, I think he might have been an anti-Semite, which is a problem when I'm quoting him, but nonetheless.
He had a couple issues.
Yeah, a couple issues, but he had a few good ones. And one of them was like, if you ask people, you know, what kind of car they wanted, they'd say like a faster horse or whatever the expression is, right? People don't necessarily know how to tell you what they need because they don't have like the lexicon for it yet. And so I hear what you're saying about sales. Because sales ends up not really being so much about what the consumer needs. It's about sort of the deals and the trade and the promotions and like, you know, that. Whereas, you know, customer experience, you are really going back to like, am I really solving your problem? Am I solving one problem but creating another problem? And you're learning all the time, like, what are the other problems that you have that I can be helpful with? So I can totally see... I can totally see how you fell in love with it.
Yeah, I think like for me, one of the interesting things that I thought of early on, and I actually had a conversation with David David from Olipop when I was interviewing. We had this conversation. You know, he asked me what is it that you think D2C brands are just kind of missing? There's something that they're missing, and I think for me the most interesting thing is that, you know, most of these customers are finding brands on Facebook through an ad, or, you know, they're getting this tiny little snapshot of a brand. They're seeing it looks beautiful, looks delicious, looks great. They click that ad. They enter this, you know, $100,000 snazzy website. They scroll down. They're on this like hype train where they're just like enthralled by a brand. They click place order. They spend whatever money they spend, and then there's radio silence for a week and a half until they get it.
Right.
And that immediacy that you have in retail, where you can pick up an ice cold can from a fridge in a Whole Foods and kind of drink it right away and feel that, is kind of lost. And mm-hmm. that magic in D2C is just lost. And brands have, you know, historically tried to up that up with a fancy unboxing experience. Mm-hmm. And that's all fun. But what I see is that sometimes customers, you know, 3-4 days into it, they're kind of feeling like, was that the right decision to spend right. that kind of money?
Yeah.
And that's like something that I think about almost daily that I think a lot of brands, you know, aren't thinking about is like, what do we do to keep the magic in that time frame? Like, yeah. what do we do to kind of keep that almost quote unquote hype that they had when they click place order, that they're feeling the same excitement up until they get that box. And then the unboxing is just a seamless experience that continues yeah. to level up. Yeah.
No, that's such a great, I just took a big note and made a big star next to it, which means I'm going to Slack that to my team the minute that we finish recording. We're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to get into more because we could do this for a few hours, but we only have like 23 more minutes. Okay. We'll be right back.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN can provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new-shows.
I'm back with Ben and Eli from Olipop. Okay. So, I mean, I have so many questions, but I want to stay on customer experience for a minute, and then we'll go back to sort of Olipop as a business and the questions I have about that. But one of the things that I wanted to ask you is just, you know, you said something really interesting in the beginning about, you know, customer service is almost the way you're framing it is that there's something that's gone wrong and you have to repair it. Customer experience, if I'm kind of paraphrasing you right, is that you're sort of mitigating for that ahead of time and you're looking forward to create a better experience so that those things don't break as often or you don't end up having to sort of be like in repair mode. Is that kind of the way that you mm-hmm. frame it?
Yeah. Yeah. That's fair.
And is there something that you do? I mean, I'll give you a very specific example, right? Again, my team and I, we had a brick and mortar cooking school. Customer service to us means like you are looking at the person whose coffee is not hot or who didn't like the class or who, you know, just had a bad day. And you learn very early on that this is usually not about the coffee or the class. It's usually just like someone needs someone to hear them. And so you learn very early on that it's just about having someone feel heard. In the case of D2C, it's actually different for us because we're getting like, we have a perishable product. We have 85 things that say like, it's perishable. Remember, it's coming and you need to be there and it needs to go in the fridge. And now we're getting people sort of saying like, I forgot and I left it out. Can I have a refund? And our customer service sort of bones from the brick and mortar want to make them happy and want to replace the case and want to do all of that. But honestly, we're also sort of like, well, we can't be sending, you know, $70 cases to people who leave it out on their own time. So that's a specific question for you. Like, how do you kind of approach those issues? And we know there are going to be more and more of them. And then the flip side of that is you said something interesting in the beginning too, which is, you know, not just when there's negative feedback, but having a really good connection when there's positive feedback. I want to make sure we're capitalizing on that as well. So I'd love to hear what you would do if you were me about the cases that are left out in the sun. And then secondly, a sort of a positive, you know, how you handle the positive feedback.
That's a great question. I think a question that a lot of brands face every day. I mean, especially brands like, you know, when I was at Nugs and Nugs was sending these frozen, you know, non-chicken chicken nuggets. I think the interesting thing is the way I think about these things is like, what is it that we're missing that's making customers not see the 300 reminders that we're placing throughout the box? And trying to think of a more creative way of maybe, you know, adding that to a welcome email or a order confirmation in a fun way that feels like we're not lecturing customers. And we're kind of taking it in a playful way. Almost the way I think about, you know, the Smokey the Bear phenomenon,
right.
You know, how they took, you know, being cautious about wildfires and made it, you know, cutesy and fun to get people's attention. You know, at Olipop, I think we do what we can to kind of get into the mind of the customer. And, you know, obviously there's an element where if somebody spends a crazy amount of money and they're really unhappy, we really, really want to do what we can to make these customers happy, but also, you know, being mindful that this is a company that, you know, we have to do what we can to best remedy the underlying issue. Instead of seeing it as, you know, one thing at a time. And to kind of, you know, flip back on proactive, I think the interesting thing about customer experience as a whole, you know, they say that I heard a statistic that the average turnover for a customer experience representative is, you know, every 3 months or something wild like that. I think that it's entirely, I mean, it's this catch-22 where if you're really good at customer experience, you have high levels of empathy.
And
that catch-22 is that, is that you feel that, right? When somebody says that they spent a lot of money that they saved for a really long time and they got the product and they didn't like that, that hurts you, right? So,
so
I think that the kind of the weird and interesting way that we go about this is like by turning this proactive, I feel like, you know, my team, which is fantastic, gets an opportunity to interact with people when they're happy as well. And an interesting thing we did was like last month we sent 75 snake plants to customers to make their day bright. You know, like this is, this wasn't anyone that ever had a problem with our brand. We picked a cohort and said, you know, these are the people we're going to send something fun to. And my team engaging with those people, you know, sending in an email with a photo and being like, you know, this is the first time any brand has ever done that. And to think about, you know, okay, this is like $1,500, $2,000, and we changed the game, right? So these people end up turning into brand promoters. And without even thinking twice, these are people that are telling their friends like, holy moly, look what this brand did. That's a marketing tool without us trying to turn it into one. And that's kind of more broadly how I see customer experience. When people are thrilled and when people are excited about not only the product, I mean, obviously the product with Olipop does the talking, but when they're thrilled about an experience, not only when they have a difficult situation, it just turns these people into super fans. And, you know, like when we decide to lean in on these kind of things, for example, when we launched our orange squeeze, you know, we had a message that was sent from like a text through our texting platform that was sent from Ben with just explaining why he created this and what went into the flavor formula. We, you know, we sold $10,000 in 15 minutes. So when we want to lean in, you know, we have the ability to lean in with these super fans and kind of really, really blow it out of the park.
And going back to Nugs for a second, right? So Nugs has this very sort of irreverent, you know, the whole, all of their terminology, all of the way that they, you know, their website, their messaging, everything is very sort of, I think irreverent is like a really good mm-hmm. word for it. Whereas Olipop is like happy and sunshiny. And, you know, do you find that the tone of the brand is translated in the way that customer experience happens, or
1,000%.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. I think that the customers inherently are different. Customers kind of look for a brand that aligns with their values. And I think, you know, in the next 5 to 10 years, we'll see that even more, that people are not buying from brands just because they like a product or just because of the price. And we have a million examples, you know, of brands that offer cheap pricing, but customers would rather pay for something that matches their tonality and their values. And it was extremely insightful to see, you know, the differences in tone from customer emails. You know, customers over there talk differently than customers at Olipop. And it's interesting because I think Olipop as a brand, like, you know, like you're saying, it's happy, it's friendly. The North Star is like talking to customers like people and not a ticket. And I think that, like, in fact, like Olipop as a brand was kind of built that way. And, you know, Ben and everyone from the top down, you know, we're a brand that spends years, you know, research and development on a product that's actually good for you, a culture that really cares about personal growth and mental health. Like, this is like, it's fascinating to me how that kind of goes top down, you know, and that's like, for me, that was the most exciting part about joining Olipop is, you know, great customer experiences in their DNA, like as people, you know, they want to make other people happy. And kind of for me, this is like the most exciting job I've ever had, where I have like the bandwidth and the resources to kind of build out my dream customer experience function.
That makes sense.
That's like, the most exciting part for me is like, you know, just being able to dive in and dig in and kind of bring this feedback and continuing to build.
Ben, back to you for a second, because, you know, right now I have 5 people on my team. The DNA of the company is essentially my DNA. The Jungian archetype of the company is essentially my Jungian archetype. Like, as we hire more people, as you hired more people, how did you make sure, or how were you comfortable knowing that all of the things and, you know, all of the values and the goals that you had creating the product were going to translate as the team got bigger, and inevitably you're not in every discussion and you're not on every team and certainly not in every meeting? Like, were there hiring things that you did specifically that?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, and you can see, just, you know, first of all, great job to Eli for articulating his thoughts in the way he did. I mean, you can obviously see why it was such a pleasure for us to have the opportunity to hire him and work with him. And we are blown away by his work every day. And so it's, you know, just like tremendous gratitude for him on a variety of different levels. The one other thing I will say, and it actually does tie into your question, but it also serves as a standalone. Just, you know, I've been thinking while we've been having this discussion, and obviously part of my function is to constantly be thinking about these things. But, you know, back to even that comment you made around the Henry Ford quote, and it's like, I have to think about leadership all the time and trying to define it, you know. And if you're going out to the marketplace with a product that is effectively trying to lead or be disruptive or create something new, you know, more or less you have to take a leadership position. And I actually think that one of the ways of defining truly good leadership is, a good leader is aware of what's happening under the surface for him or herself, and has the empathy and awareness to have a sense of what's going on under the surface for others, whether that's an individual you're talking to, whether that's a group, also whether that's society. And then the leader, being aware of their own underlying mechanics, being aware of the underlying mechanics of the other, calls to a higher purpose from a place that strikes a lot deeper. And that is one of the mechanisms by which, you know, so you, by assessing those kind of inner or subconscious terrains, you do get to these solutions that are something that maybe a customer needs or wants or could benefit from, but isn't able to articulate yet. And then that can pass its way through all the different kind of functions of the product and the company.
Well, and I think this speaks to something much bigger that is very interesting, especially in the times of COVID. So there are, like you said, there are really good products. They're less expensive products. You know, we talk about like what's table stakes these days. It's, you know, you can't not have a good product. That's not a differentiator. Something being better for you, not a differentiator, right? Having every single like icon and, you know, non this and good for that on your package, again, not a differentiator. But what does seem to be sort of separating out, you know, and I think the companies that seem to be withstanding the pressure test of COVID is this leadership, right? And it makes sense that we're connecting sort of, you're talking about self-awareness and awareness of others. And Eli, you're talking about empathy. I think, unfortunately, in the last several years, there have been a bunch of brands that have been just like founder ego led and sure. Money just flying at those egos. And they didn't do the work to know themselves. They didn't really do the work to have empathy for their consumer. And they're finding themselves in a little bit of a pickle, you know?
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, that's the thing. Like, you know, so I think people get caught in these conceptual, and, you know, I want to speak because I can be a pretty conceptual person, but I think people get kind of caught in these like conceptual traps and frameworks. And what they don't, in terms of like, oh, here's the little strategy that does this, or here's the strategy that does that. Like, and to me, that's kind of bullshit. Like, mm-hmm. At the end of the day, so as this co-founder, as this formulator, I'm living a life, and I'm very cognizant of my own eventual aging and demise. So I am trying to live a life where I actually have set out values that I continuously grow towards and live. And so then as a part of that, I would naturally try to put the extra effort into finding out what's real inside of myself, finding out what's real inside of others, and finding out what's real in terms of the people I'm hiring, finding out what's real in terms of the product marketplace, like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, basically, ensuring that there's kind of alignment that works all the way through. I think if you have something that's well executed, well thought through, is getting to the base of what's real, yes, you can bring a bunch of different individual strategies then to assist with the maximal mm-hmm. execution of that underlying reality. But right. We do live in a culture where oftentimes people walking around aren't it's like the core is gone.
Yeah.
And it's just these like, you know, borderline sociopathic little tendrils that come out to like execute things without people having a lot of awareness of like what's happening at a core level. So that also
we live in that culture, right? I mean, that's the problem with a world that is basically social media dominated, and you know, products that, you know, there are gazillions of products out there that you can swipe up to buy. Half of them haven't been vetted. Some of them are out of someone's, you know, basement somewhere. Hopefully claims are all over the place. No one can right. keep up with like what the latest is, what's real, what's not. So it's very easy to get caught and lost in sort of that surface level semi-sociopathic realm. And I mean, I think what you're saying, and I think this kind of goes to like all of my questions, and it's really interesting because I was like, how come the branding is so good? How come the team is so connected? How come like you guys just seem to hit it? Whatever you're putting out is just so good and right. And I think maybe the answer to that isn't like, well, here's how you do blah, blah, blah. But what you're saying is like, because you've taken the time and you're doing the work to get to some kind of truth that is underneath all of the hoopla. And it's just becoming, it's just manifesting itself. And it's very obvious to people who are interacting with it.
Yeah, I think that's a great, great point. And I think that also ties in really to your question about hiring. I mean, one of, mm-hmm. you know, we do have a pretty robust hiring system, and, you know, we're looking obviously for operational skill set excellence. Like, that's to your point about how you kind of have to have a good, you know, better few products, no longer a differentiator. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if you want to join a business that's growing by 1,000%, you need to be excellent in your operational skill set. But the thing that actually turns the tables about whether or not we end up going with a candidate or not is, are these kind of, I call them like depth charges. And I did interview Eli pretty thoroughly. And so he's got personal experience with this. But, you know, I really try to get into, especially dependent on the position, like the higher up in the company, the position is, the deeper I demand going. Right. But it's like, you know, I do try to really get to the core of like, what's really motivating this person? What level of self-awareness do they have? What level of psychological awareness? Have they done a lot of self-work? Are they comfortable with the reality of personal development? You know, these are all things, and then obviously how that happens to organically line up with the different values and kind of critical thought capacities that we want to have as a culture. If you can bring that into the mix and have cultural alignment and have operational skill sets and then have good onboarding systems and good cultural resonance building systems once they're in the company, you know, this kind of is like an answer that addresses, you guys haven't met each other yet. How do you work together? Right. How do you hire people? What, you know, how do you communicate to consumers? It actually still kind of all lines up on this, because it's getting to those deeper kind of realities, and then having really great, healthy empowerment devices and a certain amount of healthy autonomy once those people are inside of your system,
right,
can still build a really good culture and a really good selection criteria, you know, even while things are remote and kind of hectic.
No, and I think that makes a lot of sense. We have to finish because Jess likes it when I'm on time. But it is really interesting, because when I think about hiring, you know, I think at the beginning of my sort of like being in a position to hire, I definitely went with my gut. And mm-hmm. then I kind of felt like I hired people who maybe didn't fit the skill sets perfectly. And so then I kind of went in the other direction, and I was like, I'm only hiring for skill set, and like, I'm not going to do that gut thing, because I tend to like people and I tend to find things in that I like, and, you know, maybe
confirmation bias. Yeah,
exactly. And now I'm kind of leaning back onto the other thing, where I do think like those depth charges is the way to do it. Because if I really think about it, and it's nothing against anybody, but like the people that haven't really worked out, there's been a misalignment, not in necessarily the skills or the expectations, but in that sort of what is motivating someone. And I don't know, I think you can kind of go back and figure out where maybe things took a wrong turn because the motivation was different than maybe our motivation is as a team.
Yeah. We could have a whole conversation on hiring.
No, you guys, we could do this every week. We could just have the Ben Eli Alley podcast through in the sauce. but I do want to wrap, because I want to be mindful of Jess. And I appreciate you guys coming on. It's hard to have two, because you each obviously should have had your own episode for sure. But I thought it would be kind of fun just to have you in communion with each other. But I want to thank you both for coming on. Ben, thank you.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having us.
Eli, thank you.
Thanks a million. We definitely are a dynamic duo, right, Ben?
That's yeah. right. The most dynamic.
Jess, thank you for being the best engineer. All of you listeners, I just love I'm surprised all of you are still listening. Apparently podcast listening is down, but you're all saying no, it's not. I'm still super pumped. So I will keep making episodes, and I hope they're helpful. And I'll be next week, I'll have my 100th episode of In the Sauce. Wow.
99's not too bad. And don't forget,
yeah, the winner.
Quick plug for us. You can find us on drinkollipop.com, and Drink Ollipop is also our social media handle.
100%. And if you haven't been following Ollipop, follow them. Yeah.
And we're in over 4,500 retail locations now nationally as well. So there's a store locator on the website if you want to support your local retailer. You know, brick and mortar retailers definitely need as much support as they can get right now. So we encourage people to pick them up in either location.
Totally. All right. Amazing. I'll be back next week.
In the Sauce is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.